the second session of a series on gender theology and story. Rosemary Ruther, and we're working this afternoon on creation stories. Goes the formal part. Okay, what I'd like to start out with is to tell you a couple of creation stories and then do some reflection on how the Creator is imaged in these creation stories and how the Creator is located in relationship to the creation, and particularly in terms of human beings. And then spend a little bit of time talking about perhaps our own models of, or images of, Creator and relationship to creation and to human creation particularly. Okay, let me start out telling you a couple of creation stories. These are not arbitrarily picked, nor are they creation stories from far afield in our tradition, such as Eskimos and so on. But rather, there are three creation stories which have shaped the Christian tradition. One of them, of course, directly as the major biblical story, and two of them indirectly as creation stories that were around and about that one. The first one is the creation story that evolved through many stages in the Sumerian, Akkadian, Babylonian world until it became sort of the classic creation story that was read probably yearly as a part of a liturgy or festival of the church year. Excuse me, church year. Church year is sort of built on that ancient year, but the festival of the renewal of life that went on in the new year, the festival of renewal of creation. The second one is the first Genesis Hebrew creation story, which even though it appears as the first text of the Bible, it is not in fact among the oldest texts of the Bible. The Old Testament is not arranged exactly chronologically, but rather in terms of themes. And the actual text is fairly late post-exilic priestly text, but it appears first. And then the third is Plato's Timaeus, which is one of the Platonic dialogues that particularly gives his myth or story of creation. Now, I say that the first and the third influence the second, and I'll unpack that a little bit. The Hebrew creation story is written by people who knew the Sumerian-Babylonian story, and in some ways take it over, and themes from the Babylonian creation story appear in kind of hidden or sublimated form in that Genesis story, but they also appear scattered through other parts of the Old Testament. So the kind of imagery from that Babylonian creation story is bits of it float around, so to speak, in the Old Testament biblical text. But also the Genesis story, it seems to me, is written in some ways as a kind of critique, that there's a kind of sense of placing a new affirmation, a new consciousness in some tension with that traditional one. So in that sense, the Sumero-Babylonian story provides a kind of background for the Hebrew one. And then secondly, Plato's Timaeus, which was written basically in the late 5th century BC. But nevertheless, what was the creation story that was known to all sort of philosophically educated people who had some kind of general education. And so the church fathers, the Christians who began doing reflection and biblical exegesis and theology and so on, starting with people like Justin Martyr, who had middle of the second century, who knew philosophy, and a whole series of Christian theologians right on into the Middle Ages. We're so steeped in that Platonic creation story that even when they sought to critique it in various ways, and they certainly did seek to critique it, it still provided a kind of framework, so that if you know Plato's Timaeus and then you read things that Justin Martyr says or other church fathers, you realize that he's reading the biblical creation story within a culture that presumes certain aspects of Plato's creation story. So that's part of the reason for looking at all three of these. Okay, let me start out by saying something about the Sumero-Babylonian story. I'd like to suggest that it has, you know, it's a story that evolved. It's a part of a whole cultural tradition, and it was a worship text, not simply literary text. And so it has some layers within it, and I'll just simply suggest two major layers. First of all, that it starts out as much ancient creation story started out, not with the idea of some deity outside of the world that's before it, who then creates the world, which is the model we're accustomed to, but rather with a theogony. Pardon that nasty word. Evolution of deities, evolution of the gods. So the evolution of the cosmos is a kind of evolution that takes place through the evolution of the gods. And so you start out with a kind of sense of some kind of primordial principles within which the gods evolve. Now I would suggest that's a kind of primal womb image, that the gods sort of gestate and grow within some kind of primal womb, a primal womb that also sort of contains within it the male principle as well as the female. So this is the way it starts out. When on high the heaven had not been named, firm ground below had not been called by name, naught but primordial Apsu, their begetter, and Mumu Tiamat, she who bore them all, their waters commingling in a single body. No reed hut had been matted, no marshland had appeared. When no gods whatsoever have been brought into being, uncalled by name, their destinies undetermined, then it was that the gods were formed within them, that the gods would evolve within this primal matrix of the begetter and the bearer, mingled together as two kinds of water. Then it was that the gods were formed within them. Lamu and Lahamu were brought forth, and by name they were called. And then it talks about the other gods evolving in a series of generations. Now, sort of on top of that, that early concept of some kind of primordial matrix with male and female mingled together, and then within that primordial matrix, generations of the gods evolving, there has been laid on a second story. And in this second story, the primordial mother and her consort have become, you might say, enemies or threats to a later sort of ordered world of city-states and civilizations. And they're pictured as some kind of threat of primordial chaos that threatens to sort of break into the ordered world and devastate its achievements. And so Marduk is appointed as the champion of these later generations of gods and goddesses to slay the primordial mother Tiamat. And so he's pictured as doing that. And of course this is the prototype of what later becomes the Battle of St. George and the Dragon and other such images of the battle of some kind of culture hero with the dragon. And you have, as I said, you have remnants of that in Hebrew scripture where it talks about God slaying the primordial dragon or the Leviathan, other such words of that kind. So there's this scene where Marduk does single combat with Tiamat. And he, I'll just read a little bit of it. Then joined issue Tiamat and Marduk, wisest of the gods. They swayed in single combat, locked in battle. The Lord spread out his net to enfold her. The evil wind, which followed behind, he let loose in her face. When Tiamat opened her mouth to consume him, he drove in the evil wind that she closed not her lips. And as the fierce winds charged her belly, her body was distended and her mouth was wide open. He released the arrow and it tore her belly and it cut through her inside, splitting the heart. And having thus subdued her, he extinguished her life. He cast down her carcass to stand upon it. The Lord trod on the legs of Tiamat. With his unsparing mace, he crushed her skulls. When the arteries of her blood he had severed, the north wind bore them to places undisclosed. And then it describes Marduk. Not only does he subdue her and really reduce her, you might say, to a dead carcass, but he proceeds to split her and make the whole cosmos out of her body. He split her like a shellfish into two parts. Half of her he set up and sealed it as the sky, and pulled down the bar and posted the guards, and he bade them to allow not her waters to escape. And he constructed the stations for the great gods, fixing their astral likenesses as constellations. And he determined the year by designating the zones, and he set up the constellations for each of the 12 months. In her belly he established the zenith, the moon he caused to shine, the night to him entrusting. He appointed him a creature of the night to signify the days. And so he goes on basically creating the whole planetary world on the sort of upper side of Tiamat. Any of that sound reminiscent of anything you've ever heard before? Something else, a little bit earlier than a TV series. What? I'm thinking of something earlier than that.
Genesis.
Yeah, Genesis. I mean, Genesis has that story in the background, only Tiamat has sort of faded into being the tohu wabohu, the kind of primordial chaos stuff that God is shaping the world. But again, you have that fixing of the upper and the lower waters and the planetary spheres and so on. Only Tiamat has, as I said, faded into a kind of depersonalized kind of image of chaos.
Isn't the word for deep in the jazz is from Tahom, T-E-H-O-M,
similar to Tiamat? This is not my stuff, but the Hebrew. But tohu wabohu is what I've heard, sort of primal chaos.
Interesting. The similarities in the
words. Yeah. Anybody know the Hebrew words for it?
Well, that is right, but I don't know what the connection is etymologically. It's just
an accident. Yeah. Now, after he had sort of organized the whole cosmos out of her body, he then proceeds to slay Apsu, who's clearly a kind of an auxiliary figure in this drama. Out of the blood of Apsu mingled with clay, he makes the human beings. So the text ends with, out of his blood they fashioned mankind, and they imposed the service and let free the gods. Now that phrase reflects a whole very long tradition going back to Sumerian mythology, which is that the human beings are created precisely to let the gods become free of work, because the human beings are sort of free, you know, as they are essentially slaves. And so the relationship of gods to human is that of leisure to workers.
You had a name, I can't think of it, that wasn't Tiamat or Marduk, it was somebody else. Our starts with a name.
Apsu is the consort. Well, is sort of the primordial father.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But he's, as I said, the imagery is that of a kind of great matrix principle where the male principle is somehow kind of commingled into the female principle. And so he's clearly thought of as auxiliary to her rather than the way we would tend to assume male-female relationship. Okay, so that's just a very quick tidbit of that creation story with its sort of two levels of the primordial evolution of the gods and then this combat drama. Let me then say something about the Hebrew story. The Hebrew story is organized, and this reflects the priestly interests, organized in terms of a sequence of 7 days, and that is to make God's primordial work and rest the model for human work and rest. One of the things that struck me as interesting about that, in terms of the relationship to the Babylonian background, is the different understanding of work and rest, whereas in the Babylonian framework, the humans are created to work so that the gods can rest. In the Hebrew framework, God works and rests and bids humans to imitate God as ones who both work and rest. And my guess is that wasn't just kind of accidental change, but that there is some very clear recognition of shifting the relationship to God. In the Hebrew story, there is no theogony. God is not evolving within the cosmos. God is thought of as transcendent to it. But there is a kind of unexplained things which Christianity has never quite dealt with. Christianity, the official theory is God created the world out of nothing. But there seems to be a little something there that God is working with, some kind of stuff. Unformed stuff. So you might say there are two principles, a sort of God and some kind of unformed stuff. The beginning of creation when God made the heavens and the earth. And the world, the earth was without form and void, with darkness over the face of the abyss and the mighty wind that swept over the surface of the waters. So there seems to be sort of abysses and waters and stuff there. And there was some kind of unformed stuff. And so God's creative work is that of shaping that, and God starts out with light, and saw that the light was good. It separates light from darkness, and then obviously you're familiar with that. Fixes the vault of the heavens and the earth, and fixes the waters above, which of course is what comes down to rain from the waters below, which is what wells up in springs, and the planetary spheres, and then the living creatures, cattle and reptile. And then on the sixth day, of course, culminates in the creation of the human beings. Where are we? The human beings. Human beings, of course, are made on the same day as the animals, which I think signals an assumption that human beings are not totally set apart from animals. They're part of it. But human beings have a kind of special role in relationship. So it was, God made the wild animals and cattle and the reptiles, each according to its kind, and saw that it was good. And then God said, let us make man, and that's the generic word for human, in our image and in our likeness, to rule the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the cattle and all the animals on the earth and all the reptiles that crawl upon the earth. And so God created the human in God's own image, the image of God. He created them, male and female. He created them and blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, increase, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish and the birds and every living thing. So clearly, again, the relationship that God is establishing between himself and the world, and then particularly human beings, is not the human beings are created to be slaves, workers, but are created to be something more like stewards. So they are to, in effect, represent God. and participate as God's sort of human agents in ruling over, but I think ruling over there doesn't assume here sort of dominating or repressing it, but ruling over it in the sense of being good caretakers for God's plantation, if you will. And the term image here that does not assume that human beings, male and female, sort of look like God. That's not really the assumption of the word image. The word image really is that notion of the human beings being God's representatives. And that's the implication of that term. And that role of being God's representatives is given to humanity generically. In other words, there's no sort of, it's not given to the male rather than female or something like that, but it's a generic term. Okay, then let me just tell you about Plato's story. How many of you are familiar with Plato's Timaeus? Some of you, okay. Again, I'll just do a somewhat brief summary. The basic pattern in Plato's Timaeus. Now, Plato's Timaeus is perhaps the most conscious philosophical construction. I mean, it builds on, of course, ancient mythological and symbolic traditions, but it's a very conscious philosophical construction of one author. The Genesis story is also, I think, a fairly conscious religious construction, philosophical religious construction, but by a kind of priestly school, whereas the first one is much more, an anonymous product of perhaps thousands of years of evolution. So there's a kind of, we're moving, shall we say, to more and more sort of conscious construction of a story as we get to Plato's Timaeus. And the basic principles that Plato starts with is that there are two basic realities. There is the eternal ideas, which is a kind of a realm where all that which is the principles, the intellectual principles of all things are sort of there as the eternal reality. So the eternal reality is not, first of all, a divine person so much as it is this sort of realm of the eternal principles. And then on the other hand, there is some kind of unformed matter. And then in between these two, there appears a figure called the Demiurgos, who is, the word essentially means something like an artisan. You might even think of it as an architect. And the job of this Demiurgos, this architect, is to look up to the eternal ideas, contemplate them. You might say something like an architect looking at a blueprint. This is the blueprint of the eternal principles. And then to fashion this this stuff, unformed stuff, according to the eternal ideas. But the stuff, of course, doesn't participate in the same reality as the eternal ideas. The stuff is by nature sort of mutable. And so he doesn't make a duplicate of the eternal idea so much as a kind of secondary representation, which is as different from the difference of, let's say, a statue from the actual human being that's represented. And Plato likes to make that analogy. So you have to remember that for him, this creation is always a kind of secondary, mutable image of this eternal reality. And he starts out by shaping the two principles of unity and plurality, change, and shaping them into a kind of cosmic soul, which is really becomes the principle of movement. And then he shapes the planetary body, the whole cosmos with its many planetary spheres and so on. And for him, of course, he's working with a geocentric universe, where he assumes that the Earth is in the center and the planetary spheres and so on. And then he breathes this world soul into the cosmic body, and the whole cosmic body starts to move. I mean, the planetary spheres start moving around, and the sun and the moon and so on. And so he thinks of the cosmos as like a kind of living body. And then, having created this whole cosmic living body, he then takes the dregs of the world soul, which he had mixed, And now the dregs, again, assume that this is kind of a lesser level of the world soul. It's the same principle, but kind of a lesser level, sort of an impure residue. And out of that, he makes the human souls. And where does he place the human souls? Anybody know? Does he place them offhand in bodies? Not right away. He puts them first into the stars. And he puts them in the stars because the stars, he really has a whole kind of hierarchical assumption that the farther you are down toward Earth, the farther away you are from this eternal spiritual reality. And so the higher planetary levels are sort of closer to it. So if you're up there in the stars, you can kind of get a good eyeful, contemplative experience of these eternal ideas. He puts the souls up there in the stars, and the stars are really referred to as their sort of native habitat. That's where souls are most comfortable, in stars, according to Plato. And then, having put them there so that they can get a kind of good infusion of the eternal truths, he then gets the planetary gods, who are thought of as sort of lower deities associated with the various planets, to shape the bodies of animals and humans. And again, you have to recognize that the conscious sense that the shaping of bodies for humans and animals is just too degrading a task for this demiurgos. He doesn't dirty his fingers and something like that. So he gets these lower gods to do that. Having the souls of human beings are then incarnated into these bodies, and they're incarnated in these bodies as a kind of moral task. These bodies are thought of as antagonistic to souls, and their moral task is essentially to subdue all these passions that well up from these bodies, and try to rule them with reason. And if they manage to do a good job throughout their lifetime of ruling these unruly passions that come up from the bodies with their reason, then at death they will be able to return to their native star and live a happy immortal existence. But if they fail to do that, they will be reincarnated into some lower form of life, starting out with women. And then suddenly you think, oh. And then if they really do a bad job, they can go on from there to animals and so on. So he has an assumption of a kind of transmigration of souls, that you sort of work your way, you can sort of fall down into lower forms of life, and then but you have to work your way up through many cycles of lives until you finally manage to do the job you were supposed to do, which is, of course, to get up into a male body and live rationally, and then go on back to your happy star again. So he says, if he failed in attaining this at the second birth, he would pass into woman. And if, when that state of being, he did not desist from evil, he would continue to be changed into some brute who resembled him in the evil nature that he had acquired. It would not cease from his toils and transformations until he followed the revolution of the same and the like within him, and overcome by the help of reason the turbulent and irrational mob of later accretions, made up of fire and air and water and earth, and returned to the form of his first and better state. Okay, those are three
questions.
Classic creation stories, yeah?
Does that mean that then the first bodies were male bodies?
He's really assuming. I mean, he's not even dealing with our assumptions that the producer human being comes out of mothers. He's really assuming a kind of ideal priorities. The ideal priorities are that the normative human being is a male. And so obviously you start out by God creating male bodies and putting souls into them. And then the human females sort of come out of a fall from maleness into femaleness. So I mean, it's operating out of a theoretical hierarchical principle. You go what I call trickle-down reality, you know, and males are above females, and so that's where you start out.
Yeah. I'm not trying to explain biology, he calls it a likely story.
A likely story, exactly.
It's a self-conscious myth-making.
But the sequence of events reflects his assumptions about the hierarchies of reality and the priorities of reality.
Mark Twain said all that. He said, man is the noblest of all God's creatures. Now who figured that out?
Okay, let me try to say something about how the creator or the process of creation is visualized in these, and then how they, in a different way, locate humanity in relationship to the creative process. And we've already suggested some of that. First of all, it seems to me one model, which would be very normal from human experience, for thinking about generating the cosmos is to do it through the analogy of a female gestation. In other words, to think of some kind of primordial reality as some kind of great womb, some kind of great sort of self-generating womb in which the male principle and female work kind of together, but in some prime, and think of the deities evolving within that, and then the cosmos different. So a kind of differentiation going on within some kind of cosmic womb, and it seems to me that's a model that we start with in some of the very early stories, with kind of reminiscences and a model of the cosmos, the gods of the cosmos gestating within, growing and differentiating within some kind of pre-existent cosmic womb. I think there's another idea that's kind of flitting in there within the notion of gestation, and that's a process which the ancient Near Eastern world would have been very aware of, is that which, in a sense, created their world, and that's the process by which the overflowing of rivers essentially silted up, and the dry land appears from the silting up of alluvial rivers, and so there's also that kind of idea mingling in there, but it's thought of sort of as one part of this notion of primordial gestation. So that's one kind of model. As I said, all of these are drawn one way or another from human experience. The second, which I think is in some ways very startling, is to think of of the creation of the world as originating through some kind of military conquest, in which you literally, there's some kind of primordial mother principle that is literally slain, reduced to stuff. Now there's something interesting about it. If you look at the etymology of matter, it is in fact connected with mother. So the whole idea that you turn mother into matter, sort of dead stuff, and then that becomes simply material, which is shaped by a will outside of it. Seems to me the Marduk story reflects something of that notion of reducing primordial mother to dead matter. And then, although she seems to be rather lively with all that planetary stuff decorating her belly and so on, but I mean, he clearly is the sort of shaper of this primordial stuff. I think the third model in the Hebrew story is creation through command or word. In other words, that there's some kind of will, mind and will, that's somehow abstracted out there, outside of reality, and creates through a kind of a word fiat or word command. God, you know, said that it was, and it was. Would it be too presumptuous to suggest there's a little male seminal experience going on there as well? You know, something that's traveling up from one side of the level of the body to another here in the image. In other words, I think there's also a part of male experience that one creates through an ejaculation that again generates something in a body out there, but not within your own body.
It's a word referring to words, ejaculation.
Yeah, Jack, and there's a whole linguistic history of taking the male sexual act and turning it, sort of sublimating it into intellectual acts, conceptions, and seminal words and all that kind of stuff. So I think that sort of lurking underneath the word act is perhaps also this other male kind of experience. And then I think another obvious image for creating is artisanry. The potter creating a pot, that also of course appears in the Old Testament for God's work. And that's also is founded in Babylonian thought. I mean, much of Babylonian culture was created out of clay. It was like the Pueblo Indians. I mean, you create houses and tablets and all kinds of things out of clay. So it was a clay culture. And so it was, again, very natural to think of God as like a potter, creating all these things out of clay. Plato also uses the artisan thing, although I think he thinks of more architect and sculptor and things like that, but particularly I think architect. But that notion, again, of a of an artisan who has a kind of intellectual blueprint and then takes stuff and shapes it according to this intellectual blueprint and out of that creates a reality which reflects the creator's intelligence and shaping of it, but is of a different stuff than him. I use him here because I think that it's come primarily out of that, not that women, of course, were not potters and so on as well. So all of those, I think, are different kinds of kind of classical images for the work of creation. The gestation, ejaculation, command, artisanry, and so on. Then let me just quickly summarize the different ways in which humans seem to me to be related in these, particularly these three main stories. Well, I think in the Sumero-Babylonian story, there are really two quite different possibilities. One, if you really think of the whole creation sort of, I mean, the whole cosmic reality gestating within a primal mother, then in some ways it seems to me everything that appears would be a kind of manifestation of this bodying forth within some kind of cosmic womb. And one might think of that much more, that everything then is a kind of bodying forth of the divine. And you could think of that more pantheistically, that everything really is an expression of the divine, or you could think of it more as a kind of bodying forth of a principle that lies underneath it. I think the second story in the Sumero-Babylonian account, of course, makes a very sharp differentiation between the gods and the humans. And the basic analogy here is that of leisure ruling class to servile working class. It seems to me the Hebrews are consciously confronting that by saying that God makes the humans not to be slaves and servants, but to be caretakers, co-sharers, or representatives of God in the care for God's earth, and that therefore they are made in the image of God, not they are servants, but servants with a very different kind of dignity, shall we say, from slaves. The steward is the caretaker who represents, you might say, the absent Lord. And of course, that imagery appears a lot in New Testament parables a lot. And then clearly the Platonic model really thinks of this hierarchical dualism between spirit and matter as duplicated in the hierarchical dualism of mind over body, and that in turn becomes a kind of principle of social hierarchy or chain of being in which you've got sort of planetary gods up there, and those in the Christian tradition will become angels, and then you've got male and over female, and female clearly is seen as closer to this lower bodily reality, and the animals under that. So you've got a whole kind of hierarchy from gods down to matter, which includes human hierarchy as well as hierarchy over animals. And the basic principle is that of, you know, trickle down from spirit down to matter. Okay, any any sort of questions about that?
In none of these stories that you evoked is the classic notion of creation, wherein you actually make something from nothing.
Well, I think that's a later philosophical extraction.
That's exactly what
yeah, I mean, it's not, well, I think it's a Christian effort to try to reflect on this dilemma. And they were, of course, particularly reacting to Plato here, because they wanted, if God was all and the originating principle, they couldn't have this other principle of primordial matter. So Christianity evolved its notion of creation out of nothing, in part from kind of dialogue critique with Plato Timaeus.
Did that originate then with Christians, or is there earlier?
I don't know. But, I mean, Jewish thought tells stories and generates laws. It doesn't do abstract theological. So, I mean, these kind of questions tend to be more Christians, although later on Jewish philosophy will interact with what Christianity is. But I don't really know that Hebrew thought is raising those kind of questions, because they don't, I mean, I think the kind of marriage of theological story and philosophy happens.
Can I just a little bit further? That amongst Eskimos and what have you, there's, to your knowledge, there's no, it began with the Christians.
Thinking of creating as something out of nothing. Well, I think most stories tend to think of not that there's absolutely nothing, but there's more some kind of unformed stuff that gets formed, and that's probably, it's just probably pretty hard for anyone to think nothing. So what one thinks is some kind of unformed, watery stuff that's going to be shaped or evolve into something from unformed form or something like that. And so I think that's the way these mythological stories are done. They're not coming out of that kind of abstract philosophical thinking, but storytelling. Yeah?
No, I mean, there's one step in the process, which is that Platonism moves into middle and Neoplatonic, in which all the world is an emanation out of an overflowing of the one, to combat what they saw as the pantheistic in Neoplatonism, I agree with the example of out of nothing creation, to try to settle, to maintain the transcendence of God.
And but in that even though Christianity created the theory that God creates out of nothing, that Neoplatonic thinking also exerted a lot of influence on Christianity, not only in terms of the Trinity, which Christianity struggled to make three persons rather than a series of emanations, but also the whole notion of the Logos coming forth from the Father and being the foundational principle of the created world. There's a lot of reminiscences of the so creation and emanation, I think, are still floating around in some tension. Okay, what I would like you to do for about just very quickly, about 5 minutes, is to turn to each other in groups of about three, and discuss. See if one. Ask yourself what kind of word or image for the Creator would you find most sort of satisfying and sort of affirming in terms of your sense of how one is related to the rest of reality and to the Creator? Is one of these words grab you? Do you want to work and develop one of these words, or do you really have some other kind of image? So I'd just like you to brainstorm. I don't know what you'll come up with, but just think about what kind of word for this creator process and its relationship to you would really grab you the most. And then we'll just see what people come up with.
The fire, the creator.
All the creeds.
what's that word? What word?
There is, but Sam Ma said there's kind of image.
Well, it's just like a medieval cathedral. You also can go to the church. the dualism of life.
What could you be creating as the being of God or making?
I think one thing, that any kind of, but there's two of them just to be united, and the one that you should be and God generation wanted to make slightly more
teacher.
So I think Potter's teachers were using the play.
But it's still.
The director who sets the house.
Play that was.
That was what I was. You have to go to the stage, so just.
Yeah.
Plus, she's actually.
For the get strength of your role.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
Yeah, I like her.
Does anybody want to come back together and say some of your thoughts, or are you just content to talk in groups?
Turn off the lights, that's it.
What?
I think we'd like to hear other people's.
Yeah.
Why don't you sort of talk about your model? Okay.
I just said that the model that I kind of like the best is one of fire or of energy as God, and that energy manifesting itself in all different forms, human and material.
Yeah, we were just unpacking, we were talking a little bit about what I think is a kind of modern scientific myth, if you will. Of the great, you know, sun and the primordial, you know, the Big Bang and the spinning out of gases, and which tends to very much overcome these dualisms of that we've gotten from Plato of spirit stuff and matter stuff. And rather, if you see energy and
energy and matter are two,
yeah, really two
different forms of the same
reason. Yeah, right, and things like that. So I think
and besides the Big Bang theory, that I guess I'm comfortable with too, has been getting of the physics of things, and you try to break matter down into small little pieces, it's really just energy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's where, in a sense, our notion of a solid earth sort of dissolves at the level of particle figure physics, and you discover sort of energy in patterns and things like that.
If it wasn't the way we came in, it would probably be the way we go out.
Yeah, one
way or another. Paul Simon gave us a little image. Well, of course, there's a few biblical analogies for that, too. The fire next time and all that kind of stuff. Any other?
We were talking about kind of a director of improvisational theater.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
Well,
Elmer Witt as God, is that
we were trying to decide why you needed a creation myth, and we were talking about, well, explaining the things around you, explaining social relations, and that led us to process into the notion of that the story wasn't over. So first we started with a storyteller, but that seemed a little too structured. And we were each, you know, maybe we were comfortable with the image of the characters in a story, which was that an author will say that the character takes on a life of its own in the story. And then we said, well, maybe it's more like, you know, you set the stage, and then you put people up there, and there's a working man. Some constraints, you know, there's a limit. Costumes are set, but the people work out somehow.
Uh-huh.
What happened?
But it assumes that
the director comes back.
A director or an intelligence, which is God, where he comes from, who's like.
Just there, directing the play.
An improvisational play.
Improvisation, yeah.
You have to do a lot of your own.
We decided he had a very sick sense of humor.
Anybody got some other stuff going? I think we definitely have the nub of a few stories if anybody wants to write them down.
Write our own creation.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me in terms of creation and the creator, one of the myths of creation that really appeals to me is are the myths of the Native Americans or Native peoples.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't so much creation as something that happened back then. My understanding is that creation continues, and that the people that are alive are the same stuff of the earth that they are connected to. They are the brothers and sisters of the earth, just as they're brothers and sisters. they are part of the creation, and they help the Mother Earth to give birth and to life and to creation. And they would not harm their mother, because they would not harm themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that there's some sense of the beginning somewhere. I think they speak of the Great Spirit, which seems to be kind of a male figure, which has something to do with life springing forth out of the Mother Earth. But there's a very rich sense that now there isn't so much the time of the that we have, and the past and the present and the future, but there's just now, and that they have a very important relationship with creation, because they are a part of creation that goes on.
I think there's a bit of that actually in the Christian story too. We tended to think of it as happened, particularly in the 18th century, tend to think it happened as a finished thing, and then God just set it running. And I think the more earlier thing thought of this as a story about how it continually is created.
But that has a real male-female imagery too, of the Mother Earth and the Great Spirit.